In session about 7 after the hour on the 19th of April. Present, we have Representative Coghill, Dyson, Cisna, and Stevens. Our first order of business, we have somebody online who on House Bill 197. This is the 5 wish list for folks who may think that they're approaching end of life. And I'm sorry, what is the gentleman's name from Florida that's calling in?
Paul
Malik. Paul?
Malik? M-A-L-L-E.
All right, Paul Malik, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we got you loud and clear, Paul. Thanks for your help on this. We have this bill before us, and I suspect we'll pass it out today. Please give us your testimony and tell us what you think we need to know to be informed about this.
Summer.
Thank you, Paul. Any questions from the committee? While you're thinking, I have a couple. Paul, What forces a hospital to comply?
To comply with the advance directive?
Yes, sir.
Well, mostly they are bound by the laws of the state, which would require them to follow the advance directive if it meets the requirements in the state statute. We have been told by our counsel at the American Bar Association that he believes that five wishes would stand up in court in all 50 states because of the Patient Self-Determination Act, which is a national act that requires healthcare providers to follow an individual's wishes. We have, as I said, we've worked with almost a million people that are using five wishes, and we've not had one instance that we're aware of where an individual who filled out five wishes did not have their wishes honored.
Yeah, and thank you. We certainly have some anecdotal evidence here of that not happening. What's the or else? What's the penalty for a institution that doesn't follow them?
Well, I believe that probably varies by state, and I don't have the legal expertise to give you the analysis of, you know, what some of the suggestions would be from the different states, but would be happy to forward some of those statutes on to your good point in the direction of some of those. And I think a lot of it, from what I'm familiar with, comes from the regulatory boards, the boards of medicine in each individual state.
Okay, so do you know of any states that have criminal or civil penalties if the directives are not followed?
Well, I do know that there have been several instances where criminal suits have been filed on behalf of on healthcare providers that have not followed an individual's wishes that were spelled out in a legally valid advance directive. There have been a few of those cases in Florida, and I don't know. I don't have the actual citations of the law in individual states that would back that up.
All right. It appears to me, looking at the form, Mr. Meyer, that it's directed to elderly people and not necessarily to folks who earlier in life might be facing life-threatening terminal diseases. Is that correct?
Well, it's good for anyone who's 18 or older, and we're instituting a program now where we're working with companies that are giving out five wishes as an employee benefit. So they're giving it to all of their employees. We're working with groups like Johnson & Johnson, American Express, Ryder Trust, some big companies that are giving this out to their employees to use for themselves and for their family members. What we encourage is for people to fill out five wishes or any advance directives before they get seriously ill. And so it's definitely for anyone 18 or older.
All right. And then in our first hearing on this bill, Mr. Meyer, we were discussing whether or not the form itself ought to be put in state law as opposed to being referenced in law and maybe being a regulation or something. Do you have a view on that?
I do. I think that it would probably be better to reference the form rather than including the actual document word for word in the state statute. We haven't had a state do that yet. And one thing that I would see is posing a slight problem down the road is that if there were any changes to five wishes, there were changes in laws in some of the other states that require a minor change or just simply a layout change for five wishes, we'd have to come back to you and ask for another statute to be passed for any small revision. And that being said, I don't think that that's a complication that we would have to face simply because if you include a medical advance directive in the statute, that still gives the residents the ability to use another form, I think that does accomplish the same goal.
All right, thank you. Any questions from the committee from Mr. Meyer? For Mr. Meyer? Thanks for your help. I suspect Representative Hudson's office will be back in touch with you a little bit as we continue to work on this. And sounds like you all are being a great service to a lot of folks, and we commend you for that, and thanks for helping us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Thank you. All right. It is my intention that we will we're going to take care of a couple other bills here, and then we'll get back and take testimony from all of you who are here on House Bill 197. Are there any of you here on House Bill 197 that can't stay for 40 minutes, or that would be inconvenient? I appreciate that. It's my intention to take House Bill 180 and then House Bill 65 in that order, then we'll go to 197 and probably House Bill 209, maybe 112. Are you here to get into that one, Representative Cargill?
I'm ready anytime you are, but...
Okay. All right.
At your pleasure, sir.
Representative McGuire?
Yes.
Are you going to present your bill?
Yes, I am. Chairman and members of the committee. You have in front of you ACS that I would respectfully request that the committee adopt. That is version LS0642/P dated 4901 that incorporates a couple of changes from the previous document.
Is there an objection to the CS? If not, then we have before us as a working document CS for House Bill 180/B, Lauterbach 49 this year.
Thank you, Chairman Dyson. With your indulgence, I'll just proceed. You have a copy of the sponsor statement and the bill, I'm assuming that the committee has a basic idea what it's about. I wanted to let you know a little bit about what spurred this particular bill. The bill requires background checks for volunteer child service workers. I have a gentleman in my district who is online and will be able to share his own story with you. But of the four children that he has, three of them have been victims of sexual abuse while in under the supervision of volunteer child workers. He has obviously an intense frustration over that that I can understand. And this bill is an attempt at trying to minimize the level of risk that a child is exposed to in the hands of volunteers. We have a lot of laws in our statutes that regulate specific state services, foster care homes, those types of things. The area of volunteers is kind of a vague one that's out there, and there are some organizations, such as the Boys and Girls Club, who have recognized a need for this and have taken it upon themselves to require background checks of their volunteers. And the cost associated with that background check is a $20 fee. And that fee can be paid by the volunteer themselves if they wish to volunteer. It can be paid by the organization. The organization can obviously solicit donations from private industry to help pay for that. You'll notice in the bill that we did opt for mandating a state background check as opposed to a federal. And, Mr. Chairman, although I would love to see federal background checks, it is cost prohibitive for some of the organizations, and so this is an attempt to make a step, but not to be so punitive as far as the costs. And that was a concern, and that's why you see the state criminal background check only. We have provided some exemptions in the CS: Sunday school teachers, nursery volunteers at a church, parent, guardian, or relative participating in school-sponsored functions. And again, that was an attempt at trying to narrow down any unintended consequences that the bill might have. I do have a couple of amendments that I would also like to offer for the committee's consideration that have come up, and I'll just go ahead and briefly say them to you now, and if the committee chooses to adopt them and move them, so be it. The First Amendment would be on page 1, line 11 and 12, and would delete reference to current offender, rather serious offense. Current offender information is what it would delete, and make it so that the report then can only not show a conviction involving a serious offense. And the concern there is sort of a due process one. If they haven't been convicted of it, are we being unfairly punitive? That's something for the committee to discuss. How far you want it to go. That's one proposed amendment. And then on page 2, line 27, it would add parent, guardian, or relative of a child, or relative of a child, so that it would end up reading while a parent, guardian, or relative of the child is in attendance at the religious service. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll take questions. I think the goal of the bill is very clear. We want to try to protect our children in any way that we can, and statistics show that where there has been a conviction in the past of sexual molestation, there is a higher degree of risk. We cannot protect our children 100%. We can't put them in a bubble, although we'd love to. But we can, as a legislature, take steps to try to minimize those risks. This would be one of those steps, requiring the background checks. And one thing I want to make sure that the committee is aware of is that there are some due process aspects to the bill that are important. If you notice on page 2, lines 16 and 17, the individual can challenge the accuracy and completeness of the report. So there is that opportunity for the applicant to have a say regarding what is found if the conviction is inaccurate. And with that, I will take any questions, and I want to point out that Jack Bolin is on the line. He is the parent that I referenced earlier, and I know that he wants to offer testimony today.
All right. Representative Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question. What is the cost of the federal check that you were talking
$99.
About? $99. I see.
And that includes a fingerprint card.
Thank you.
Representative McGuire, the way I read this, you would have to get the background check for a babysitter.
Representative Dyson, we have been trying through the use of amendments to minimize the vagueness of it. And we feel that the goal of it is relatively clear, and that when you start stretching it out to logical extremes, you can include those things in it, but that it is pretty clear. However, I am amenable to any amendments or any modifications to this bill that you or the committee believe would help get at the goal that we're trying to do in protecting our children, and at the same time not have unintended consequences. So, and that's, you know, when we put in the amendments regarding Sunday school and school-sponsored activities, those were specific criticisms that we heard, so we incorporated it. I'm amenable to making any changes that you think would make it better.
This committee has just been through exactly this exercise in dealing with people providing care for seniors. And how do you do it?
Right.
And my reading of this bill is you and your husband couldn't take the neighbor's kid with you on a camping trip, you know, without doing a background check. And you're the attorney, not me. But
well, and let me just say one thing real quick. I know Representative Sisson has a comment, which is, you know, this is one of those difficult tasks as a lawmaker. You recognize a problem, and then you try to get a bill drafted that addresses the problem. We've looked at what other states are doing, and this bill is kind of in line with what other states are doing. At the same time, we have wrestled. I think we've worked harder on this bill than any other bill we're doing because of those concerns. We don't want it to be overly vague or overly broad. But at the same time, it's very difficult to put your hands around it. We've met with Department of Public Safety, talked to them about it. We've discussed the idea of, instead of a stick, that we create some sort of a carrot, an incentive program, like a Safe Kids seal. That you can get for your particular organization that says we are regularly conducting background checks. We're just not sure how to get our hands around it. We decided to have the hearing today and not to pull it off the calendar so that we could get it up here for discussion, so that you could wrestle around with it, and so that we could try to make it a better bill.
Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I read this correctly, and I may be missing something, but on page 1, line 6, it immediately says the background check is required of a child services provider.
Right. And it defines that.
That is different, unless unless it broadens itself out after this, and I didn't catch that, if a parent decides to act as the hiring agent, if you would, for someone that comes into their home and provides a service, that's different than putting your child in a situation where you have the assurances that someone has taken the same effort that you yourself would take. So it doesn't take the responsibility away from the parent in
right.
terms of those one-on-one things
right.
that happen in a neighborhood, but it does, it holds the child care provider accountable, which is a little different because you may know the child care provider, but you're not going to know everyone they maybe hire
that's right.
or get as a volunteer.
That was the intent, Representative Sisna, through the chair.
And you don't think it would apply to anyone beyond, I mean, it doesn't broaden
itself out. I think that it's relatively clear. There have been concerns. There always are where you sort of run a bill out to its logical extremes. And like I say, Representative Sisna, through the chair, I have tried to minimize and add in areas to make that very clear. I think it's pretty clear, but like I say, again, I just want to see this kind of a thing adopted, so I'm amenable to any suggestions that will make the bill better, that will make it less broad, if folks feel it does.
Representative Stevens?
Mr. Chairman, I just wonder if Representative McGuire could just run through some thoughts on who a child service provider is. I'm not really clear. You're talking about not volunteers working for a child service provider. So how does that work? Because I remember always paying for babysitters, and we're talking about volunteers here.
Do you want to answer this, Sue? She's been wrestling around with this. There's a definition section in there, and it says provider means a business, organization, or entity that provides child services.
Well, could you sort of specify, we're not talking about scouting, we're not, I don't think. Were you talking about the Boy Scouts? I don't believe so. We're not talking about church clubs and organizations, youth organizations and churches.
We're trying.
Yeah, I'm going to stay in the middle of this referee.
Okay.
Representative McGuire to respond.
Oh, okay. It is, our intent there is to make it the specific child care service providers. However, there are some who I think would fall into it, for example, YMCA, where they're offering daycare services and facilities and things like that, who would fall into it, and that's our intent. We'd like for them to fall into it.
Representative Stevens, on page 3, line 2, child service means treatment, education, training, supervision, recreation. And then provider on line 11 means business, organization, or other entity with public, private, profit, nonprofit, volunteer that provides child services, meaning treatment, education, training, instruction, or recreation. You know. So I think the Boy Scouts are in there, and Girls Club, and so on.
Mr. Chairman, like arts organizations that have summer camps and Native organizations that have summer camps.
Yep. And I would think if you wanted to push it, that it's the local neighborhood babysitting co-op, you know, where half a dozen parents get together and rotate who watches the Rugrats while somebody else gets their hair done. That's what I always do.
Mr. Chair, this is a business. This definition is a business,
nope.
And that's different
nope.
than a cooperative.
Nope. Look up page 3, line 11.
Representative.
Business, organization, or other entity, whether public, private, profit, nonprofit, or volunteer, that provides child services, line 12.
There is a concern, and there's a debate about this, and like I say, I wanted to have this hearing. This is
Representative McGuire to respond.
This is a constituent of mine who has a very serious concern about this that I recognize. He has, since he has brought this to my attention and since I've drafted the bill, I've received over 150 concerns from parents. So this is our attempt. We left it up to ledge drafting to try to incorporate our concepts. it's a tough issue to get your hand around. Even DPS admits it's a very tough, difficult. It is not my intent to reach out to arts organizations and all of these other types of things. That's why I say let's have a hearing on it. Let Jack Bolin say his piece, and let's see if we can get some suggestions. I'm prepared to work on it in the interim to try to narrow it down so that it's a real good bill.
Yeah, and all of us who have been around Child Protective Services around know that some of the predators are out there signing up to be volunteers and supervisors and so on. And when I was a little boy growing up, we all knew where the chicken hawks hung out. Representative Coghill?
You always make my point before I get there.
I'm sorry. Strike my last conversation.
However, having said that, Mr. Chairman, I think rather than mandating that you can't employ somebody, we need to do everything we can to encourage people to check up on who they use as volunteers. Because if we start coming from a mandate position, then the next logical thing is everybody's going to have to carry a card that has all these marks on it. You know, I can see us going down the wrong road. But it is wise, there's no doubt in my mind, as somebody who's worked with volunteers, to have them check up on who they're getting to do the volunteer work. And so I think the carrot in that way is a whole lot better because you're encouraging that responsibility. As a matter of fact, I think there's probably case law that says if you don't do that, you're liable. The way the bill is drafted now, with us going out and picking up children for Sunday school, we would be mandated that we check up on them. It doesn't give us any freedom. We do check up on them, but the mandate at this point, I think, would be on the wrong side of the issue.
Representative Sisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If, in fact, on page 3, line 2, it said child services means the professional care, is that too specific? Or, I mean, would that, it would rule out certain kinds of things, but professional is kind of one of those things that says it's different than the neighborhood co-op.
Yep. Representative Sisna is volunteering to work with you during the interim.
Yep. I hear it.
And she had a lot of good experience. I want to get to these two folks that want to testify. First, we'll go to Jack Bowen and then Dick Block. And I think they're both in Anchorage. Can you hear me, gentlemen? Jack Bowen in Anchorage. Can you hear us, Jack? Yeah, please, Jack, identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony, please.
My name is Jack Bowen, and Representative McGuire hit on most of the points that I was going to hit on. However, there's some that she didn't hit on. And all of you have received an email from me and or some of your own constituents with regards to this. And around the middle of February, first part of March, I sent out an email about a program that's going to be on the Discovery Channel. Basically, it was about pedophiles and where they operate. And one of the things that they do, they associate themselves with organizations as a volunteer, and then they groom the child so that they can have access to them by themselves. This does not exclude anybody. Anchorage newspaper and Watch TV. Here's Anchorage teacher sexual contact, Anchorage teacher sexual contact, fire chief sexual contact, Wasilla teacher sexual abuse of a minor, Fairbanks minister 12 counts of sexual abuse of a minor, sexual contact, indecent exposure, Anchorage hockey coach, drug possession, Boys and Girls Club employee, Fairbanks sexual abuse of a minor, murder from a little girl in Sitka. And these things have got to be stopped. I work for an organization. I work as a volunteer for an organization that does a lot of work for kids. I work for Little League, and I work for Alaska Basketball Softball Association. And we run background checks on everybody that coaches with the kids. Some organizations do, some of them don't. My youngest daughter, unfortunately, came in contact with a coach with an organization, did not run a background check, and he was a multiple
Jack, I appreciate you talking to us, Mr. Bowen, and I'm sorry about the tragedy with your child. You've obviously been thinking about and working on this, and you heard a little bit of our debate here. We're trying to figure out where to draw the line, you know, with babysitters and kids going over to sleep at their friend's house and so on.
I don't think babysitters like in the neighborhood type of thing applies. I do think Boy Scouts, Cub Scouts, Anchorage Sports Association, any of the organized organizations that have volunteer working for them where they officially provide youth care services, I think all of those should be included.
Okay.
$20 is not much for a child's life.
You're exactly right. And we all know what a profound impact sexual abuse has on children. They're often victims for life. Dick Block, are you there, Dick?
Yes, I have already intended to testify, but since you called upon me, I'll simply make a very, very brief comment. And that is, I, for the record, my name is Richard Block, Christian Science Committee on Publication for the State of Alaska. And my concern when I first reviewed this piece of legislation was that it seemed to be broad enough to cover Sabbath school teachers and those volunteering to work in a nursery during Sunday services. And I'm sure that was not the intent, and certainly ought not to be the reach of the legislature. I really want to do nothing more than to thank Representative McGuire and her staff for accommodating our concern. She's already put the amendment into the committee substitute and has even proposed a modest wordsmithing that I had asked for a proffered amendment this afternoon. So really I have nothing more to do than to thank her for her consideration of our concerns. And with that, I have nothing really further to offer on the bill.
All right. Thank you and appreciate your interest. And we all agree Representative McGuire is wonderful. Any other further questions from the committee of either the two gentlemen that testified or for the sponsor? Representative Stevens?
I just wonder if Jack could tell us, does your organization pay for this, the small fee, $20, or is that done by the volunteer?
Volunteers. However, I have my background check run once a year, and I've also had a federal background check run on myself, and I can keep a copy of those records. And as a coach for one of the high schools for Anchorage Public Schools, Little League, and the Alaska Basket Softball Association, one background check is good for all of them. So if you're working as a volunteer for more than one organization, it's still only a $20 fee, no matter how many organizations you work for.
Thank you. Representative Stevens?
Can I follow up, Mr. Chairman? I'm just making a list of the things my three children have been involved in, and I assume, and I think you're quite right, that the opportunity for people to cause damage is out there. But making a list, I've got summer softball camps, kids wrestling, piano teachers, dance teachers. All of those would be on your list of people who would be subject to this this check. Is that right? Well, you obviously don't have
children around, yeah. And they're left alone by the parent there. I would think the parent would want to know that the person does not have any intentions for assaulting a child. And it costs $20. If there's somebody out there that can't afford the $20, I'll pay the $20 for it.
Well, if I can respond, I think you're absolutely right, but I just think we need to know exactly what we're talking about here and how extensive this requirement will be.
I would tend to take a stand that would probably be a little more rigid than some people because of the experience that I've gone through. My two oldest children were assaulted by a school teacher that was a physical education teacher. My oldest daughter, from the time she was dead until she was 16, my son, and now my youngest daughter, my coach, who worked for one of the sports organizations here in Anchorage.
Any further questions? I don't think we're ready to pass this out today. I would suggest to you two things to consider, and certainly I think Mr. Bowen alluded to one of them, and that is the organizations that have stature in government. Either, you know, they pay taxes, or they have filed as a nonprofit under a couple of different categories. That might be one place to start retricking it. Another suggestion I would have is that any organization that by their nature has to have insurance, see if there's a way that if we can tailor the laws so that if they do background checks and so on and so forth, their insurance rates go down, or contrarily, if they don't do background checks on stuff, their liability insurance doubles or triples and the extra money goes into the permanent fund or the general fund.
Tie that in.
Something I'm sure you could figure out something there. But those are just suggestions.
Thank you, Chair.
Yes, yes, sir.
This is Jack Bowen. One of the ideas that I had was that if an organization didn't perform a background check and they lose their limit of liability with their insurance company and their insurance company would be forced to pay the judgment, what this would do would make the insurance companies require the organizations to take and run the background check or they couldn't get insurance.
Yeah, exactly what I was thinking, Jack. Great minds. Jack, can you... I guess we're not on television today. Representative Guire is writing frantically or industriously. All right. All right. Thank you. If you don't object, Representative McGuire, I'd like to suspend the hearing on this. If you have something before the end of the session that you want to come back to us with, we'll be glad to put it up.
Thank you, Representative Tyson.
All right. And so we'll suspend our hearing on House Bill 180, and we're now House Bill 65. Wait a minute. Is there anybody else here that feels like they need to testify on 180? All right, thank you. Now we'll take up House Bill 65. Tim or Elmer, would one of you turn the lights on over there?
I thought it was a nice.
It was a nice mood. I
okay, turn the lights off.
Yeah, turn them off.
Tap off. Tap off.
Children of darkness.
The light over there, that's nice.
Who's going to make the presentation for us in House Bill 65? Welcome home, Karen. We haven't seen you in a long time. If you stick around, we'll kick 209 out of here today, too.
Oh, okay. You want to join me? In case you ask me any real questions. For the record, my name is Commissioner Karen Perdue from the Department of Health and Social Services. I want to testify on House Bill 65. I want to thank you for considering this bill today. I have a couple of statistics I wanted to give you on breast cancer and cervical cancer and what it's doing in Alaska. In 1997, which is the last year that we have the full data for, we had about 284 women, actually almost 300 women, who were diagnosed with breast cancer in Alaska. 41 women died, actually 41 people, I'm sure most of them were women, died of breast cancer during that year. 26 women were diagnosed with cervical cancer, and 4 of them died of that disease. We all know that early detection and screening has dramatically improved in our state and in our country, and that our early detection and early treatment can reduce morbidity and mortality, reduces mortality by at least 30%. So there has been a huge effort on the part of the health community to make available both screening for cervical cancer and mammography. We have also in the department been working on that in that we have a breast and cervical early detection screening program. And that program has been gathering steam across the state. It's fully funded by the federal government. Last year, I believe we screened about 15,000 women who were low income under that program. They were also all under 65 years of age. The what happened is that this program was of nationally being used, and of course women were being diagnosed with cancer, and at that point not having the ability to pay for the treatment. So the Congress last year made available as an option to the states the ability to provide coverage for the treatment. We have estimated that we would cover around, well, let me back up. Last year, the breast and cervical cancer screening program in Alaska, the one that screened 15,000 women, uncovered about 39 breast cancers and 33 cervical cancers. We think that it's likely that about 17 of those women would be eligible if this bill had been in place, who had breast cancer, and 27 who had cervical cancer. Simple answer, we think around 40 women a year would benefit from this treatment program. The cost of this is being borne to a great degree by the federal government. If we were to pass this bill, the cost we estimate to be $175,000 in state general funds and $413,000 in federal funds for a total of around $500,000+ per year. And we get those costs from running the Medicaid data because we do cover women now who are at much lower incomes for these treatments. So what we have done is we've taken their procedures and averaged out those costs for a year. The coverage is only through the treatment phase of the program. There are cost-sharing requirements in the program, but the basic philosophy is that many of these women, of course, are getting treatment, but that any day of delay, once the cancer is diagnosed, can be very, very concerning. So it's very, very important to get right in and get started on your treatment. So I think with that, Mr. Chairman, I will obviously we support the bill. I think I wanted to just conclude by making a couple of comments about some of the concerns that have been raised regarding this approach, probably nationwide. One of the issues that has come up is, well, why this disease and why this body part? Because certainly there are lots of constituents that we hear from that don't have health insurance for lots of diseases. I think the answer to that simply is that the system that we have for health care coverage for people who have no health care insurance is imperfect. And we do not have the ability, when we see opportunities to provide coverage for groups, then I think it's a valid public policy choice to determine whether we want to invest in those coverages. One of the problems with women who, anyone who has this cancer, is that it's not possible at that time to get private coverage, because at that point you have a pre-existing condition and it's, you know, virtually impossible to go out on the private market and obtain the insurance at that time. We do have a high-risk pool, but there's a six-month waiting period, and that, of course, would also not be beneficial for the treatment. So the truth is that we are trying to work within the constraints of the healthcare system as it is, and this would provide a benefit to 40 women a year in Alaska.
The record, Representative Coring has joined us about 11 minutes to the hour.
Thank you.
Any questions, Karen? Representative Coghill.
Karen, thank you. This goes under the Medicaid, under the Children's Health Insurance Program?
No, it does not.
Okay.
Through the chair.
So because I was looking at in the statute, and it looks like it's in a different category, but you make mention in the that it's going to be under the same federal match rate as the Children's Health Insurance Program?
It's an enhanced, through the chair, it's an enhanced match rate, correct. It's, okay. I think it's 75% federal.
It'll be 70.17
71.
Next year.
Okay. So what is the vehicle? Under what title, then, is it?
Well, it's an optional group, is that right, under
yes,
Title 19?
Title 19. It's Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Stevens.
Mr. Chairman, this is a subject very close to my heart because anyone who's had family who has dealt with this, it's you're very fortunate when you've got the insurance and early detection. But just for the record, and I would certainly want to make sure that everyone had that opportunity to have early detection. But for the record, what are the results of not having early detection? Obviously, you're talking about cancer progressing and and death from cancer, I assume, unless early detection takes place. And just so you, medically, can you run us through that?
Yes, I could. And Representative Stevens, with the indulgence of the chair, I'd like to ask Mary Diven, who runs our screening program, to give you some of those results.
The later it's detected, the greater the chance, Chair Sir, for metastases, for it to spread to other parts of the body. And the death rate is much higher the later it's detected, or once it's detected, if the treatment is delayed.
Dyson, I hear conflicting things from the medical services suppliers, providers. One of them says it's a myth that people can't get care. And in fact, if a person's got a serious illness and they show up at the emergency room of the hospital, they're going to get cared for. And they say, we don't turn anybody away. I know one of the constituents who beats me about the head and shoulders every time I have a community hearing says, you know, she has got a cancer and she's now $380,000 in debt. But in fact, she's got the treatment, you know, and doctors and the hospitals that have provided her, they're holding the bag, you know, not the state government or Medicaid or the federal government. But is it true that if you've got serious illness in this state, if you show up at the hospital, they're going to treat you?
Field are providing a lot of pro bono care, or people are paying a portion of the care, and I think that would continue under this. This will not solve the problem of uninsurance for everyone who has cancer in the state. I think it would be good to address that question, though, to women who have had the disease and their thought process as to how they were going to pay those bills, or their thought process as to how they were going to struggle along in terms of what they could demand from the healthcare system if they did not have insurance. So I do think that we do not have an insensitive medical community in this state, but I do think that the access issue, you know, isn't totally solved by just saying let's let the private sector carry the burden.
Yeah, because as I understand it from talking to those guys, they turn around and charge you and me more in order to subsidize those indigent people who
that is,
can't or don't pay.
And that is absolutely true and will continue to be true until every person who walks in the door has somebody paying the bill.
Yeah.
That's correct.
So I had a brilliant question. I lost it. Representatives Sisson and then Coghill.
Not that I don't disagree with a concern that that if to the greatest extent possible that we try to encourage people to be responsible, but at the same time, on these sorts of things where people may hesitate because of a matter of issue, of a matter of money, of how in the world am I going to pay for this, and delay, the public cost for it keeps going up. And in fact, if you're then fiddling around with far more extensive medical care, it does make a difference in terms of how fast people respond, whether or not they think they're going to be able to live a life afterwards, or are they going to be a slave to, you know, or not even a slave. How in the world are you going to do it? So,
Representative Coghill?
Karen, what is the eligibility? And you mentioned a copay. I'm just kind of curious about that.
Do they have in their packet the chart?
No.
Okay. We have a chart which we can make available to you that tries to decipher this, but let me just try to find a. Okay. Harry, why don't you run through that?
Okay.
Through the chair. The eligibility for the screening program is that women are detected through this federal program, and they have an income less than 250% of poverty. For the treatment program, the income is the same. One of the eligibility criteria for the screening and diagnosis program is that they can have insurance, but if the deductible is too high,
then they're eligible for the screening. For the treatment portion, they would not be eligible under this Medicaid option because their health insurance would cover it. So the treatment portion is only for people with no other insurance coverage at all.
What would, Ms. Dyson, what would be the, what, what's the annual figure, 250% of the poverty level right now, roughly?
For one person. For one person, let me have got it here. It's in this. You'd think by now I'd have it memorized.
You know, Nancy? I would suspect that a lot of the individuals, women we're talking about, are not 65, but somewhat older in age than, you know, 30s, and probably many of them single because they don't have the ability to have insurance in the family. You know, they wouldn't have a spouse, for instance, so maybe they're divorced or widowed or that kind of thing.
For a family of one, that's $26,000.
250% is $26,000. Mm-hmm. And is there any qualification in terms of the assets they have?
No.
So they could have $100,000 in the bank, and as long as their annual income, two Cadillacs.
And again, it's one of the main public health goals is to get the early detection. And if somebody is delaying getting their annual exams, then the goal is to get the detection early to reduce the long-term costs for treatment. And then if they do have any insurance coverage at all, they wouldn't be eligible under this, but there is no asset testing.
From Senator Coghill.
On the funding issue again, obviously the federal funds are going to be a significant portion of this.
Yes.
And do we know what the commitment to this is under this authorization?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Coghill, this is an option that's been created for the states under congressional law. I have never seen one repealed. So the answer to your question is, you know, usually when Congress offers this, they stick with it over the 30 years that has had the Medicaid program.
Mr. Chairman, and one of my concerns is twofold. One, the federal government says, here, do this.
Yes.
And then we end up with that ball in our lap, and that concerns me. Then the other issue is just the continually adding of what are health care issues that it seemed like every one that we debate is one of the most important ones, and we wouldn't be debating it otherwise, I'm sure, but we're getting a longer and longer list, and I am concerned about that. And you hate to sound like a real ogre when you bring these issues up, but the fact is the pay is going to be on somebody, and if the federal government decides to change their mind, we will have it in statute, and it will be in our responsibility to pay that. And if the list is so long, it could be problematic, and any other issue is I'm always concerned about replacing the private insurance market with the public insurance or service, if you will. So as we go down that, I have to scrutinize it with that without sounding like a real ogre, but we are going down that road.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Coghill, you do have some legitimate I understand why you're asking those questions. I do think that on the issue of the private market, it's really important to remember that this can be a pre-existing condition for insurance. So it's a barrier for the ability to get insurance on the market. And as I said, of course, if you have the cancer and you try to go out and procure the insurance, I really don't think you can get it. So that's an ongoing problem. And it's a dilemma we face every day, and we are used to the fact that we always have to cut this off at some level, you know, and then there's going to be a person, sure enough, that's going to show up if we do this, who's right above it. I don't deny the arbitrariness of it. I just think that it is an opportunity, and I think that by the time this year will be done, I would imagine that about 20 states will have adopted this that's a guess, and it could be more. Mm-hmm. So it will be difficult for the Congress to retreat from the commitment they make to the states.
And we do know through the chair that although it was
passed... You need to identify yourself every time you speak for the transcriber.
This is Mary Diven with the Division of Public Health. Even though it was passed under the last president, President Bush and Tommy Thompson, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, are calling each state that's passed it personally to congratulate them for having passed it. So we know there is support under the current administration as well.
It seemed to me like one of our own senators, Senator Murkowski, was carrying that issue. So
this was passed unanimously by the Senate at the federal level.
Representative Sisna?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is probably not the crucial question of the year, but I am somewhat curious. I know we had lots of stories about welfare moms and Cadillacs and stuff like that, and yet I never met any, and I've worked with a lot of folks that have been in tough times. One of the words that goes out to one of the things that you get told over and over again by healthcare providers is that as a woman over a certain age, you're supposed to go in for your annual mammogram. And most of the people I know have taken that really very much to heart. Has there, in the process of working on this, have you figured out what voluntary efforts there have been to comply with that recommendation? And because 40 people who this might apply to a year seems like a rather small amount. And is there really a big concern about people divesting themselves of their quitting their job and going away because they want to get this free, but they want to keep their Cadillacs and their palaces?
Through the chair, Representative Sisna, one of the things about an asset test that I think we need to think about in Alaska as we get to the point where people have land and the urban areas have grown up around them is that people can also can be very land rich, but cash poor. And that has been a phenomenon that's happened in other states. And I think if you're making $26,000 a year, you're probably not able to make many payments on a lot of things, a lot of toys or cars or, whatever you want to call it. I guess boys call them toys and women would call them...
Necessities.
Correct. Boats, that kind of thing. But there are, people do have their houses, and again, if you bought 10 acres of land, out in the hinterlands, and all of a sudden a subdivision comes in around you, you have some assets. So that's one of the reasons why I think it doesn't actually worry me that the asset test isn't necessarily there. We don't often see people trying to game the system that much.
And we've got some people that want to testify, and I suspect that for some of them, they're schedule problem. Do you want to ask another question?
I'll wait for the question.
All right. I have, let's see.
Oh, that's not it. I'm trying to help you.
I got three or four people trying to mother me.
Are you done with us?
Please don't leave, but yeah,
sorry.
Hang on. All right. Off net, I've got Dr. Whitefield, are you online, Doc?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, please give us your testimony.
I actually called to testify about
I'm sorry, what bill?
112.
Okay, I'm sorry. That won't be for a while, and my apologies.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to go down the line here. We've got people in a couple different places. Is there anybody here in the room to testify on House Bill 65 that has schedule that you've got to run? All right. I've got five people in Anchorage, and I'm going to take the top, the first three there. I would appreciate it if you could make your testimony concise. And please don't feel a necessity to say what others have said, but we really do value your testimony and want your input. First one I have is Barbara DuBois. Can you hear us, Barb?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we got you loud and clear.
Okay. My name is Barbara DuBois. I'm 51 years old. I'm uninsured. I've been diagnosed with inflammatory breast cancer. I was diagnosed in December of 2000, so it's been about 4 months ago. I was diagnosed through the state screening program that we talked about that allows uninsured eligible women to three-yearly screening. If I had not had this program, I would not have gotten early detection. As it turned out, I was originally diagnosed with a stage 4 cancer, which is the worst you can get. But because I was early detected and my treatment is becoming very successful, I have been downgraded to a stage 2. So early detection is a lifesaver. That's all there is to that. Unfortunately, they gave me the diagnosis, but they didn't give me the funds to treat myself. Women in my position generally have three options. You can go on state aid. You can quit your job, have the state pay for everything. You can only have $500 in your possession. You have to give up everything as far as any financial goes, including any retirement funds that you may have. So, but the state would then pay for everything for you. Or you can do what a lot of women would do in this situation, seek substandard or no treatment. The recourse there, of course, would be probably fail. Because when you get substandard treatment, then you don't get the result. Or you can get the recommended treatment and accrue a lot of debt, which is what I chose to do because I think I'm worth it. The medical bills right now that I have accrued before my surgery, which was a week ago Monday, were upwards of $40,000. Now my cancer is an aggressive cancer and it's an extensive cancer. I've had chemotherapy already for 12 weeks. I've had a mastectomy and I have to go back for more chemotherapy and then for radiation. So I'm accruing some major bills. More than likely will wind up filing bankruptcy at some point because they're going to become very overwhelming. So the fact that the federal government has allowed for these funds to complete the program, the screening program is like part one, and this particular medical assistance program is part two, where it allows women to have the financial aid that they need. I've chosen to continue working. I didn't want the state to pay for my rent, to pay for my food. I can still work, and I still want to be a productive part of society. So I've chosen to work and not get state aid as far as my everyday living expenses. As a result, I'm not getting any other aid either, and like I said, I'm just accruing massive debt. So the financial burden is becoming overwhelming as I was looking at my medical bills this morning. Paying everybody that I could $10 here and $15 there, that's the best I could do. A woman shouldn't be penalized because she chooses to work and not choose the state aid. We should be given the opportunity to continue to work and maintain a lifestyle. House Bill 65 could actually save the state money by allowing a woman to continue to work and not go on the state dole and only receive the medical assistance as opposed to giving up everything, quitting work, and having the state pay for everything. So I think that House Bill 65, it could be a good thing. It could save lives and it could save more than that. It can save a woman's dignity. And I thank you for your time.
Well, thank you, Barb. And sure pleased that your treatment has gone so well. Next, Robin Smith.
Thank you. I'd like to.
I think you hit the mute button.
It was on a second ago. My name's Robin Smith, but I support this bill, but I'd like to defer testimony to Marcia Hastings, who's with the YWCA, and she's very active in this.
Sure.
Okay, so to Marcia Hastings. Thank you. I'm Marcia Hastings. I am the Women's Health Director at the YWCA. I have been in that position for a long time, 1993, I believe. We have been providing outreach to medically underserved women and that
started out as a partnership with the federal government, the Centers for Disease Control, to provide outreach services to reach medically underserved women. If we did not have the financial resources of the screening program, what our community health educators would be doing in the community is finding women who are without financial resources, who are uninsured or underinsured, and telling them the message of early detection, and telling them that they should have annually a mammogram, a clinical breast exam, a pelvic exam, a pap test, and then saying good luck and walking away. Because of the breast and cervical cancer early detection program, we have been able to refer them and help them navigate the healthcare system to receive these screening services at no cost. My intent in speaking today was to put a personal face on the problem of women refusing the screening services because they wouldn't have resources to pay for the treatment. Beginning early on, when we would reach women in the community, oftentimes they would say, I don't want to know, I don't want to be screened, because if I find something, I will have no way to pay for it. I have spoken with women who have come through our program, and I might add that currently, in the last 6 years, we have 3,500 women that are actively enrolled in our program, and we continue to help them receive their annual screening services through the state early detection program, Barbara DeBois being one of them.
Can you summarize, Marcia?
Yes, I can. Point being that women are refusing screening services because they can't pay for treatment, or they are refusing parts of treatment and taking not the normal standard of care. There are real human faces on the figures, the numbers that you're looking at, and $175,000 is not much to place on the value of a human life if you're looking at 40 women or so. We're not just talking breast cancer either, we're talking cervical cancer, and no woman should ever need to die of that cancer. Early detection and treatment. I do want to, I'm sorry I'm going over time, but I do want to address the fact that you spoke to people not going untreated in our community. Fortunately, there are many physicians and medical facilities that are helping women. That's not to say that the women are not incurring incredible amounts of death. And as one last face on a project, as a woman was detected with breast cancer through the early detection program and took it upon herself, very feisty woman, and I'm sure she wouldn't care if I told you her name, but I will refrain from doing that, and did everything that was required. She had her surgery, she had mastectomy, she did her chemotherapy, her radiation, and every time a bill came in the mail, she put it in a shopping bag in the back room because she was busy tending to keeping herself alive. And probably 9 months after her treatment, she came and sat down in my office with three trash bags full of bills. And we spent many hours that day and much time later getting her life sorted out so that she can make $5 payments for the rest of her life to a variety of resources. So $175,000 with 70% federal matching funds is really silly to not just go with that. Thanks very much for letting me testify.
Thank you. Now we have Robin Smith, unless you'd like to defer to Carla Williams. Robin, your choice.
I'll defer. Yeah, this is Carla Williams, and I'm testifying today to provide an historical perspective on H.R. 65. The first legislation was introduced in Congress in 1997, because back then, as we realize now, that it borders on inhumane to tell a woman that she has breast cancer through a brief screening program and then essentially leaving it on her own to find treatment. The intention of the early detection program was to reduce breast and cervical cancer mortality in this country, but screening and diagnosis laws do not prevent cancer deaths. As Mary Dillon Gibbons announced a little bit earlier that the U.S. Senate gave their unanimous vote to this federal legislation, and the House was 421-1. So there was a lot of support, and as you probably heard, even last night on Channel 2 News, the governor again expressed his concern about this bill, that it wasn't moving forward. His comments were that this is a must-have legislation. Some previous discussion has been concerning the 250% of poverty funding level. I have submitted written testimony to this office today, which supports that the 250% number is reasonable and necessary. The figures I've used in this cost analysis were moderate to, in some cases, actually fairly low. And if you take a look at that cost analysis, you'll find out and that you can match it to your own and find that I'm telling the truth on that. One last thing I'd like to mention, I was went to a Senate presentation last week on Medicaid, and one of the, regarding this issue about not having any assets, I remember the Medicaid presenter saying that there's a trend that away from making people spend down with regard to the recent options added to the Medicaid program. Spending down, obviously, for those of you that don't know, is making sure that you don't have any money left before you go into these programs. He mentioned something about the fact that that is not a good idea and they were going away from them. If you have any, go ahead. If you have any further questions, you can reach me by phone during the day at 677-3032, or you can call me in the evening at 345, and I'd be happy to talk to you about this bill.
Thank you. Any questions? All right. Dr. Colleen Murphy, are you online and were you wanting to testify on House Bill 65? Dr. Murphy, can you hear us? All right, then if you hear from her again, let me know. Is there anybody else here in the room that wants to testify on this bill?
Hey, Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Karen Robinson, and I'm here testifying on behalf of the Alaska Women's Lobby. It has a membership of men and women of about 1,500 and a steering committee of about 15, and we strongly support this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for having a hearing. And I think the experts are here to give you the more details, but we just wanted to go on record in support of it. I think probably an interesting thing that we noted is that of the 12 steering committee members, unfortunately, all of us have lost a friend or a family member to breast cancer in our lifetime. And I think not one of us is over the age of about 52 at this point. So I think that is pretty painful for most of us, and that two of our 12 members right now are going through chemotherapy themselves for breast cancer. And so we feel real strongly whatever you can do to assist women who need the help, this is a good start. Thank you.
Thank you. Jennifer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jennifer Rudinger. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Civil Liberties Union, and for all the reasons that have already been stated, we support this bill. We thank you for hearing it today, and we urge the committee to move it out.
Yeah, Jennifer, can you answer a couple questions for me?
I don't know. I'll try. I'm probably not the expert on this, so.
No, but you are a bit of an expert on legal things. And once we take a particular disease, in this case cancer, and add it to the list of things that are carried, you know, specifically, are we opening ourselves up to actions that once you start treating cancer, we must treat all cancers equally?
Well, I'm not an expert on that. I think that the flip side of that is that historically there has been a lack of attention to so-called women's health issues, although we certainly think that this affects everyone, men and women. But historically there's been a lack of research on diseases that primarily affect women. And so you could flip that around and say that this is leveling the field a little bit and giving long overdue attention to something that's been neglected. Are you opening a door? I don't know. I mean, there have already been arguments that there is discrimination, for example, in coverage, health coverage for Viagra and not for contraception. There's always discrimination. It usually is the women's health issues that are left out. But I wouldn't worry about that because the argument is usually on the other side.
Well, but in fact...
But again, I don't know. I'm not getting a definitive legal opinion
on that.
Yeah,
so we had Judge Santan's decision saying if you're going to provide one service in a particular medical area, it happened to be pregnancy services, you got to provide them all. And if we start dealing here specifically with a disease, are we in danger of that kind of thing? From, you know, based on his decision.
I don't see that the two are directly analogous, but I would rather look in, I will look into that actually and get back to the committee.
Okay.
Because I don't think you're opening up the same door, and I will look into that for you, I promise.
Okay. And it's further to his argument, if you ever have provided a service, you know, then that you might, it seemed to me he was making a case in the one that came out last year about this time, you know, that you can't stop doing it. And that was an interesting...
No, Mr. Chairman, if you're referring to the funding case, yeah. No, Mr. Chairman, what the decision says is this, that appropriations are up to the legislature, and the legislature does not have to fund any health care, certainly. There is not, and he took great pains to say, there is not a constitutional right to funding. However, once the legislature undertakes to do so, it cannot discriminate based on the exercise of a constitutional right. And so that was the gist of the decision. It's just don't discriminate. If you don't fund anything, you're not discriminating.
Yeah. So if we don't fund any cancer, are we fine? But if
I
we fund
that,
one...
See, again, because abortion under the Alaska Constitution and the Valley Hospital decision, because reproductive choice and reproductive freedom are given great privacy protection, it's not analogous to other types of health care issues that don't have the same kind of privacy associated with them. It's just not the same thing. I will look into that for you and explain this better.
Yeah, yeah. That one gets over on the edge because you can argue that cervical cancer is getting close to reproductive services, as is prostate, you know. But, yeah, I would enjoy hearing
that. Well, the disease hits. I mean, the privacy affects the choice. There's no choice to get or not get a disease. It's not... It really isn't the same thing, and I'm just not explaining it very well.
No, I'm probably not.
I will look back.
All right,
I'll
thank
get
you.
Back with you. Thank you.
All right, we will go then back to Anchorage. The next person I have is the very generous and considerate Robin Smith or Sharon Yurbich. Yeah, please go ahead.
Yes, I'll defer to... yes, my name is Sharon Yurbich. I am in support of this bill. Survivor, but I also have four daughters, one of which was trained by this program several years ago. As luck turned out, she did not have breast cancer, but if at that time she had been diagnosed, there would have been no treatment, and she would have been in a quandary. And it would not have only affected her mental health, but family. And I just encourage the House to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Robin, do you want to talk to us?
Well, basically, what I just wanted to say is I do when we have federal matching funds of our dollars, to seven of the federal dollars, we should take advantage of it and use our money use that money in a great way as opposed to earning them. And I think we also have to look at the impact this has on families. I mean, if a family with has children, their mother's diagnosed with this, and then they incur enormous debt, it ends up having all these type of things that ends up having radiating effects on our communities. I personally feel that it's too bad that we can't come up with a universal health care system in this state, or in the country, excuse me. We haven't got it this time. I think we should take advantage of every opportunity we have to cover people who aren't covered presently. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. There's two people here that are off net that I'm not sure if they're what bill they're on. I got Diane Shecker and Chris Cromer. Can either of you hear me?
Yeah, I
can. Yeah, Chris?
Yes.
Yeah, please. Which bill did you want to testify on?
I was going to testify on behalf of House Bill 209.
Okay, we will try to get to it. We may not today, but hang on. Thank you. And Diane, how about you?
Diane.
All right.
My name's Dr. Colleen Murphy. I'm not sure if you've called my name on this bill.
Yeah, I did, Colleen. Yeah, please give us your testimony.
Yes, please. My name is Dr. Colleen Murphy. I've been listening to this and actually seeing real-life patients during this hearing at 3 o'clock. I'm an obstetrician-gynecologist that works in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm currently a participant in the CDC-sponsored breast and cervical cancer early detection program. I just want to tell you that this is real. This is very real. Is that as the women actually access the screening services, we invariably will encounter the abnormalities that they're intended to detect. And I cannot tell you how distressing it is for a woman to find out that she has a precancerous process and then not be able to afford the treatment. So it makes absolutely no sense for us to initiate an evaluation process and not make the same eligibility criteria available for us to treat the patient fully. I want to mention that, in fact, this very morning, I have a permission from a patient that I saw, age 23, Ms. Ada Lee from the Valley, who is apparently a constituent to Lida Green. She gave me authorization with her signature that says, I authorize Dr. Colleen Murphy to use my name during testimony at the HES committee hearing on 4-19-01. It is okay for her to describe my medical condition and financial challenges. This is a 23-year-old woman who delivered a baby 3 months ago and is currently breastfeeding. She had a pastor abnormality during pregnancy that is a high-grade squamous intraepithelial lesion. Coposcopy, which is looking at the cervix, was performed approximately 3 weeks ago. The biopsy, which was done by a doctor in the Valley, shows that she has severe precancer. If the patient is not treated in the next couple months, she has a 70% likelihood of progressing to invasive cervical cancer. Okay. The discussion we had this morning revolved around how is she going to pay for further evaluation and treatment. I want to let you know that the doctors in Alaska face this every single day, where we see patients that have diagnosable diseases, treatable diseases, namely breast and cervical cancer, and the patients simply cannot afford the care and follow-up that's needed to be done. I really want to encourage you to complete the process and close the loop. Currently, we know cervical cancer, if people get adequate screening, it is 90% preventable. Death from cervical cancer is 90% preventable. But it's not enough to get a pap smear. The pap smear is only a screening technique. We have to do colposcopy, and then we have to do treatment. And that treatment may involve the treatment of cervical cancer. Same thing with mammography. We know that if a woman gets a mammogram on a recurring basis, the likelihood of her dying of breast cancer decreases by at least 30-40%. There's no point in getting a mammogram if we can't afford it, we can't provide the treatment. I really encourage this committee to pass this bill so that the women that are income eligible, for the CDC-sponsored program to go ahead and get the full treatment for what is basically preventable death. Those are my questions. Those are my comments. If you have any further comments or questions, I'd be happy to entertain them.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Murphy. I don't think there's any questions, and we appreciate both your testimony and your patience with us. As far as I know, we've got everybody that wanted to testify on this bill. Any questions or discussions in the committee? Representative Stevens.
Mr. Chairman, just interesting to go through the fiscal note here, and just to point out something for the record. Of the four grantees who did the testing and diagnosed 39 women with breast cancer, 61% were Alaska Native women, but they are not covered under this because they're covered under the Public Health Service, and I don't comment on that. So when you tell us that there are 300 women in Alaska with breast cancer, does that include, is 61% of that Native women, or are they outside of the facts and figures you gave us? And that percent seems awfully high, 61%, way beyond the population figures.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, the numbers I gave you on the 300 women, those all women. And but the numbers we gave you on, what was the 61%? Could you?
What's on the fiscal note? It's the 61% of the breast cancer patients, what it's talking about. It's talking about the four grantees in Alaska who diagnosed 39 women with breast cancer. And it's not a major issue. I think it should be in the record that we are not talking about Alaska Native women. They are covered under the public health system.
I'm Nancy Weller with the Division of Medical Assistance. We think that the high percentage of Alaska Native women is due to the fact that three of the four grantees are Alaska Native health organizations who have CDC grants. One is the state of Alaska, and then there are three Native health organizations. And anyone with creditable coverage under the HIPAA definition, the Health Insurance Portability Act, would not be eligible for this option, and that excludes people who have military, Medicare, Indian Health Service, and any kind of health insurance coverage.
So of the 300 women in Alaska, that does include people who are will not be covered under this, right?
That's correct.
Any other questions or discussions?
Yes.
Representative Coghill.
I thank the commissioner for letting me take a look at the U.S. code. This is hard to read. They're worse than Alaska. Or did we take lessons from them? I don't know which. But I'm just real nervous about adopting into our the definition here, this code, because I think they could change this code as they will and put us under obligation without us knowing it. Would it be that much more difficult to put what we would expect the 250% of poverty, as you might have, say, with pregnant women not covered and other issues like the under 21 that are in this? I think in some places we have 300% of poverty, some places we have 200%, some places we have 250% under this rule. So, and it looks to me, though they reference the act, they don't actually encapsulate it as we will do it according to this code. They only give it as an authority, as I can see through here. Would it be wrong to ask for us to have that spelled out in this bill?
Nancy. Once again, Nancy Weller with the Division of Medical Assistance. Actually, when we were drafting the bill, we had a lot of discussion about whether we should, reproduce all of the language from the federal law into the statute, and we thought it would be easier to describe it like that. And, in fact, it is as incomprehensible as the rest of the Medicaid statute, which, if you look at the Medicaid statute, it does reference specific sections in federal law, so only those of us who work at the Medicaid program could really interpret for you what they were talking about. But if, in fact, you did want to put specific language in there that described the bill, I could help you on the parts that were critical, which are in the part that you're looking at, Section 2, would be the part in double A,
right?
Not under age 65, screened under the CDC program, and not otherwise covered under credible coverage.
That's all it would be?
those would be the main qualifiers. And Mr. Chairman, I think I'd rather have that in statute and then reference this as an authority rather than in code that.
All right, so, we have two options then. You can either do this as a conceptual amendment and do it as skillfully as you two can craft it here in a couple of minutes, or you can take a little more time. We're going to meet on Saturday, 11 to 1, and do it then. And I'm open to either one.
Well, I would defer to the department to come up with a language. You know exactly what you want. If I crafted it, you may not get what you want.
but you two could craft it here as a conceptual amendment. You know, if you state your intention carefully enough.
Why don't we do that? Okay.
It's your call.
Well, I don't want to hold the bill up. I object to the movement that we're going in the direction of, but I also understand that this is a very highly sensitive issue. I get beat about the head and shoulders by a number of people. But I at least want to put sideboards on it and say this is exactly what we intend to do and not say whatever the federal government says we can do, we'll do, you know. I think we need to have an intent in our language, because if it lands in our lap, I want it very clear what we're talking about.
So are you going to amend it or not?
Yes. I guess I'll move the conceptual amendment that we only reference the U.S. code and have them describe clearly what the qualifications are. I think that's probably where we're going, right?
And can you tell them, make it more specific with the particular part of the federal code that we would be importing in here?
Yes. I have the language right here, and it's highlighted. I could give that to committee staff.
Okay, why don't you read it, and then we'll give it to the staff, please.
Okay. The individuals who would be eligible were those who have not attained age 65, have been screened for breast and cervical cancer under the Center for Disease Control and Prevention Breast and Cervical Cancer Early Detection Program established under Title 15 of the Public Health Service Act 42 U.S.C. 300K, et cetera, and need treatment for breast and cervical cancer and are not otherwise covered under creditable coverage as defined in Section 2701C of the Public Health Service Act 42 U.S.C. 300 small gg paren small c.
Is there objection? All right. Amendment, the conceptual amendment offered by Representative Coghill, ably assisted to import these sections of the federal code, passes. What's the wish of the committee? You want to vote on this or not, Representative Jewell? It's the cervical cancer.
I understand. Yes, I do.
For the record, Representative Jewell has joined us at about 40 past the hour. What's the wish of the committee? Representative Sisman?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill number 65.
As amended.
As amended.